This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The new Netflix series Orange is the New Black is based on the memoir of the same name by our first guest, Piper Kerman, about the year she spent in a minimum security women's prison. Later in the show, we'll hear from the creator of the Netflix adaptation of Orange is the New Black, Jenji Kohan, who also created the Showtime series Weeds. Piper Kerman was a 24-year-old graduate of Smith College in 1993 when she flew to Belgium with a suitcase of money intended for a West African drug lord. This misguided adventure began when she entered into a romantic relationship with a woman involved with the drug smuggling ring. Kerman left that life after several months. It wasn't until 5 years later that she was named as part of a drug conspiracy ring. In February 2004, she reported to the Federal Correctional Institution in Danbury, Connecticut. Piper Kerman is now a vice president at a Washington, D.C.-based communications firm that works with foundations and nonprofits, and she serves on the board of the Women's Prison Association. Terry spoke with Kerman last Monday and began with a scene from the first episode of Orange is the New Black. Piper Chapman, played by Taylor Schilling, is eating one of her first prison meals at a cafeteria table with several other inmates, including Nikki, played by Natasha Lyonne. An inmate named Red, played by Kate Mulgrew, walks over and gives each woman, except Piper, a container of yogurt. Red speaks first.
Who's this? Oh, this is Chapman. She's new. Self-surrender. I think she's fancy.
Here. Fancy. Have a yogurt.
What do I have to do for it?
You're new. You're one of us. Consider it a gift.
Thank you. Thank you so much. The food here is disgusting. What?
Did I mention that Red runs the kitchen?
I'm sorry.
Honey, I know you just got here, so you don't know what's what, but I'm gonna tell you. You don't like the food? It's no problem.
Holy, that was an epic.
Piper Kerman, welcome to Fresh Air. So if we watch the Netflix series, how much of your actual experience are we really seeing in there? Like how accurate is it to what really happened?
The television show, the Netflix series, is an adaptation, and there are tremendous liberties taken. What that means is that when you watch the show, you will see moments of my life sort of leap off the screen, such as, you know, Larry Bloom's proposal to Piper Chapman is not so very different from the way that my husband, Larry Smith, proposed to me when Piper Chapman insults Red, who, you know, runs the kitchen with an iron fist. That is actually very closely derived from what's in the book and from my own life. But there are other parts of the show which are tremendous departures and, you know, pure fiction dreamed up by Jenji Kohan and by her remarkable team of writers.
In both the Netflix series and in your memoir, there's a lot of what you call tribalism. For instance, you write, when a new prisoner comes in, if they're white, they're welcomed by the white prisoners. If they're African American, they're welcomed by the African American prisons. Ditto for the, you know, if you're Latino, you get the Latino welcome. And the people from your tribe who welcome you also kind of help you out at the beginning, help orient you. And things sound like they remain tribal. So would you describe some of the ways that tribalism figured into your prison term in Danbury?
The first day I arrived, I was processed in through R&D, which is in the main prison facility. And so I experienced the prison guards, and they were scary. And then I was put into the general population in the unit where I would be living. And I was really scared, and women began to approach me, and they said things like, "Do you need some shower shoes? Do you need some toothpaste? Can I make you a cup of coffee? This is a really bad day, Kerman, but it's going to get better, a little bit better tomorrow." And that was the phenomenon of the welcome wagon. And all of those women were white. And so the welcome wagon is organized. It is a true phenomenon. You know, that was not true only for me. That happens generally for each new prisoner who comes in. And it is organized along racial lines. So white women step forward and give the white woman who's new, you know, the shower shoes or whatever she might need, because the prison does not provide things like toothpaste. So when you are first setting foot into this unit, into this strange new community which you'll be living in, you know, race is a really powerful organizing principle. What I found is that over time, it was less and less important. So my work assignment in the electric shop was not made along racial lines. And so, you know, I had coworkers who were, you know, black and Latino and Asian. And another phenomenon that you touched upon was this idea of prison families. And that was a really fascinating and powerful way that people survived in prison, is that they formed these sort of, informal prison families, sometimes with a mama and sometimes a papa. And, you know, a mama would have her quote-unquote kids, you know, younger women generally who she took under her wing. And sometimes those women would feed, you know, the younger prisoners and just generally sort of care for them and counsel them and comfort them. My prison family ended up being, you know, with that formidable, you know, the boss of the kitchen. You know, she was my essentially mama. And her family, like her little prison family, was co-ed. You know, she had black daughters and white daughters, and, you know, it was less tribal in some ways than what is depicted in the show.
In the Netflix series, the woman who had been your lover back in your college and post-college days, who got you into the trouble that you got into, She's the one who asked you to carry the briefcase of drug money. In the Netflix series, she's in the same prison you are, in the same unit. It wasn't that way in real life, was it?
It's interesting to me. Folks are constantly trying to analyze, you know, what's realistic and what's unrealistic about the TV show. And one of the things that is drawn from the book is the fact that I ended up face-to-face with my ex-lover in prison. It happens in a very different way in real life and in the book than it does in the show. But, you know, in truth, I ended up sharing a cell with my ex-lover.
Sharing a cell with her?
Yes. And her sister. You know, her sister was also there. Her sister was also involved and spent a lot of time in prison.
Well, that seems so impossible to me. Like, if that was written into fiction, I'd say, oh, come on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, truth is much stranger than fiction when it comes to the criminal justice system.
What kind of terms were you on with each other then? Were you blaming her for the fact that you had been implicated in this, you know, quote, drug conspiracy, you know, for telling on you? Did you?
Actually, I was really holding on to a lot of blame in terms of saying, oh, you know, this, I'm here because of her. And actually being able to confront her brought me to the point of recognition that my situation was my own responsibility and my own fault. She offered me a quote-unquote opportunity, but I chose to take it. You know, she didn't hold a gun to my head. She didn't make me do anything. She asked me, and I said yes. And so I think that if I had not been brought face-to-face with her, I would never have gotten quite to that point of taking full responsibility for my own actions.
Piper Kerman, thank you so much. Glad you told your story, and glad it's been made into such an interesting Netflix series.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's really nice of you to invite me to come and talk.
Piper Kerman speaking with Terry Gross. Kerman wrote the memoir Orange is the New Black, which was the basis for the new Netflix series of the same name. That show was created by our next guest, Jenji Kohan, and its premise comes from the memoir. A white middle-class woman named Piper is sent to prison years after agreeing to transport a suitcase of drug money. But beyond that, the writers have created a fictionalized version of Piper's story and fictional backstories for the other inmates. Terry spoke with Kohan last Tuesday and began with this scene from the series. in which Piper Chapman has just been given her first bunk assignment. An inmate, DeMarco, played by Lynn Tucci, introduces her to her other bunkmates and gives her the lay of the land.
Tell me your name again.
Piper. Chapman.
That's Miss Rosa. And that's Nichols. Just got out of SHU a week ago. Told the CO
to kiss her ass.
Dumb. Might make trouble for yourself, you know?
SHU, that's solitary?
Yep. And you don't want it, honey. Trust me. Here's some toilet paper. Gotta take it with you.
Thanks. What's that thing?
Oh, that's my machine. I need it at night. When I first got here, I had a massive heart attack. Do you know about the cop?
Wait, can you go back to the heart attack?
I don't like to dwell.
How do I make a phone call?
Need a pack number. Fill out a form or rigmarole. But maybe Caputo will let you make a call later. It helps if you cry. Don't make it bad!
What?
We'll make it for you.
Oh, no, that's okay. You don't need to do that.
Honey, we'll make the bed. We know how.
I know how to make a bed.
We know how to do it, so we'll pass inspection. You can help clean. We clean everything with maxi pads.
Seriously?
Yep, it's a head scratcher, but that's what we got.
So we make our beds in the morning before they can...
You sleep on top of the bed with the blanket over you.
What if I want to sleep in the bed?
Look, you can do what you want. But you will be the only one in this entire prison that does. You want that? Be my guest.
That's a scene from Orange is the New Black. Jenji Kohan, welcome to Fresh Air. So this is your second series about a middle-class woman who ends up doing something criminal. In Weeds, she's dealing marijuana. And in this, the main character has carried drug money, a suitcase of drug money, and years later is busted for it. And that's why she's in prison. So what interests you about the middle-class woman who has an element of criminality in her life? It's not violent criminality, but it is breaking the law.
I think...
And they're both connected with drugs.
Yeah, particularly for this project, in a lot of ways, Piper was my Trojan horse. You're not going to go into a network and sell a show on really fascinating tales of black women and Latina women and old women and criminals. But if you take this white girl, this sort of fish out of water, and you follow her in, you can then expand your world and tell all those other stories. But it's a hard sell to just go in and try to sell those stories initially. The girl next door, the cool blonde, it's a very easy access point, and it's relatable for a lot of audiences and a lot of, you know, networks looking for a certain demographic. It's useful.
There's a really big cast. I didn't count, but there's like, I don't know, some like 12, 15 regulars on the show. And you want us to know all of their backstories, which is a really tricky thing to do. So, you know, basically every episode has one or two backstories in it. And right. So we slowly get to find out why each of the women in prison is there, what their lives outside were like, what's the crime that they committed. And it usually puts that character in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you come up with that as a structure to tell the stories of multiple people?
Right. Well, in terms of the flashback device, you know, when you're writing a show, this is your life. And I did not want to spend all my days in prison. It seemed really oppressive and potentially depressing. And I wanted to build in a structure where I could get out and these people could get out and we could have some blue skies, wear some actual clothes as opposed to uniforms. And the bonus of that was you get to see a fuller picture of who these people are, because everyone wears a mask to a certain extent in prison. You take on a persona to survive. And there's more to these people than just what they're displaying in this extreme situation. So what started out as, gee, I really just don't want to write scenes in the same set all the time, became a way to flesh out these people a lot more.
One of the things I really like about Orange is the New Black is the casting, the actresses. The series is an opportunity to showcase the talents of a lot of black and Latino actresses who don't seem to get a lot of roles, at least not prominent ones. Was that one of the reasons why you wanted to do the series in the first place?
Again, I never go in thinking, I want to cast black and Latina actresses. When I go into casting, it's just about, oh, who's going to inhabit this part and become this character. That said, the wealth of talent in this pool has been remarkable. The women that Jen Houston, our casting director, has brought in are so talented, and the bench goes so deep. Like Crazy Eyes, who's one of the real breakout characters on the show, I think it might be number 50 on the call sheet, and she's a star. They're all stars, and they're dazzling, and they're enthusiastic, and they adore one another. And when their scenes are done, they stick around and watch other people do their scenes, and they hang out on the weekends, and it's kind of been a love fest on set. Which I'm so grateful for. And part of that I attribute to one of our producers, Lisa Vinicor, who moved to New York to do the show for me. And she's kind of den mother and works with all these women and plans activities. You know, they all walk across the Brooklyn Bridge and go for pizza, or they all go salsa dancing. And she's really created an environment where these actresses are supporting one another and doing such a high level of work.
You mentioned the character Crazy Eyes is played by the actress Uzo Aduba.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the character for people who haven't seen the series.
So Crazy Eyes is has a lot of mental issues, and prison has become a dumping ground in a lot of ways for the mentally ill, as the safety net kind of melts away. And we wanted to talk about that. But we also just loved this woman who finds herself attracted to Piper and loves her so deeply and acts out so inappropriately and can't really process her feelings and her behavior very well. And yet there's something so vulnerable and poetic about her.
Why don't we hear a scene with her and Piper? So this is Uzo Aduba as Crazy Eyes, and Piper is played by Taylor Schilling.
Hello, baby. Look at you getting your sweat on. You look how shiny. I bet you don't even smell funky. Oh, I knew you wouldn't. You a real woman, Chapman, a real grown woman. And not like all these other girls around here. I can't waste my time with these silly bitches. I need a real woman.
I'm sure that you'll find one.
I wrote a poem. You want to hear?
You know, that's fine.
Before I met you, the sun was like a yellow grape. But now it looked like fire in the sky. Why? Because you light a fire inside me. I wrote it for you.
You know, my fiancé is a writer.
I'm gonna call you Dandelion. Because they're pretty and yellow just like you.
That's Uzo Aduba and Taylor Schilling in a scene from the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. We'll hear more from the show's creator, Jenji Kohan, after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Jenji Kohan, the creator of the new Netflix series Orange is the New Black, which is set in a women's prison. The show features a large ensemble cast and delves into the backstories of many of the characters.
Let me talk about another character who's in it, and this is the character of Sophia. And Sophia is a transsexual, male to female. And when Sophia, in her earlier life, was a male, she was a firefighter. Mm-hmm. And tell us about the person who you've cast in the role.
So Laverne Cox is a transgender woman and, you know, came in and took it. But the greatest, one of the greatest miracles of Orange is we seem to bring in the people we need at the time. And there are little miracles that occur all the time. And our Christmas miracle with Laverne was we wanted to do a flashback episode in which she was still a man. And Laverne's a woman, and she has breasts, and she doesn't have body hair, and she You know, it would have been very, very difficult to show her as a man. And it just so happens that she's an identical twin. How does that happen? I don't know. Things like that seem to happen on this show. And her brother came in and did a great job. And we have this one scene where he goes down to rinse his face in the sink, and then she comes up in prison, and it's the same face, but it's the male and the female. And it was extraordinarily lucky.
Did you have any idea when you cast her that you'd be able to do that?
No, and in fact, it was a joke, because we'd already been talking about stories we wanted to do, and we knew we wanted to do a Sophia flashback episode, and we were joking, God, okay, we need a transgender who's a really good actress and is also an identical twin, ha ha ha, and we found it. It was remarkable.
Well, let's hear one of her early scenes. And in this scene, the main character, Piper, played by Taylor Schilling, has gone into the bathroom, and there's no stall. I mean, there's no door on the stall, so that's making her really uncomfortable. And Sophia, played by Laverne Cox, who we've just been talking about, is in the bathroom too, and she's trying to put Piper at ease and trying to show her the ropes. So they talk about the fact that Piper is still wearing the shower shoes that she was given because she hasn't gotten her commissary money yet. And so here's the scene.
The commissary ain't come in yet?
Oh, I think so. My ID number doesn't shop until tomorrow.
You better hope they got what you need. They ain't had powder foundation in dock for 3 months. Can't be walking around here with white face on. With those sad patch shower shoes, I'm not gonna save you. You need some of these. I made my own. Couture. Commissary don't carry a size 13.
Is that duct tape?
Metallics are very in this season. Don't hold your big bathroom too long. Prison food stops you right up. You gotta get it out while you can. If you wanna skip that shower line, do the 5 a.m. or the 5 p.m. That's my secret.
Why are you telling me all of this?
Because I f*** your hair. That looks broke. When your commissary comes in, swing by the salon. I'll fix it right up for you.
Thank you.
There's no point in playing shy, baby. You're home.
That's a scene from Orange is the New Black. My guest, Jenji Cohen, is the creator of the series. How did you put out the casting call? Like, when you're looking for, you know, so many different main characters, do you just call the agents or what?
Yeah, no, a breakdown goes out, and we're looking for, you know, Latina woman, early 20s, black woman, ghetto, middle-aged Russian, you know, whatever it is. And you get a whole bunch of people. When Jen goes through casting and sends all the auditions, there's a range, and there are different interpretations of the role. And sometimes it's exactly what it was in your head, and sometimes someone comes in and brings a whole other color to it that you hadn't thought of, and you suddenly realize, oh my God, that's it. That was the right way to go.
If you put out a casting call that says black woman ghetto, isn't that just the kind of casting call that really annoys a lot of African-American actresses?
I'm sure. But, you know, you're not going to write a novel on a breakdown. You have to use a few words and see who comes in, and hopefully they have enough faith in us. Or they don't, but they want the work, and you figure it out.
You are the showrunner of Orange is the New Black. Explain what that is.
Wow, okay. I run the writer's room. I have final cut in the editing room. I approve all the casting, wardrobe, sets. I'm the big cheese, I guess. On this show, this is my baby, but I'd like to think I'm a benevolent dictator, and that one of my great skills is hiring people who are really good at their jobs and for the most part letting them do them.
Yes, and you have said in previous interviews that writing for the Tracy Ullman show taught you how to run a healthy show where people were good at what they do and were kind to each other. And I read that and I thought, as opposed to What did you experience that wasn't that way?
You know, there is this cycle of abuse in a lot of writers' rooms and productions, and it doesn't have to be that way. And when you're spending upwards of, you know, up to 15 hours a day with people, I think it's really important to have a no asshole policy and surround yourself with people who are really good at what they do but are also pleasant to be around. Particularly in a writer's room, if there's a predatory person in there, or someone who's going to attack everyone else when they open their mouths, you're not going to get the best out of people. You have to create a safe space. Not to say that all writers aren't smart asses, and if you throw the ball, they're going to hit it. You know, these are the people I spend my time with, and I don't want to be with nasty, unpleasant people.
So right before I came into the studio to record this interview, I got midway through episode 9 of Orange is the New Black. And I had just watched the scene where a character who seems clearly based on Ira Glass, who hosts a show that's clearly based on This American Life, has entered and is at a little Thanksgiving dinner that Piper's fiance is at. And Piper is the main character. She's the one who's in prison, and her boyfriend is trying to, she's just been put in, well, I shouldn't give away too much, but anyways. I haven't seen what happens with this Ira Glass character yet, but what did you want to accomplish by, and I should mention that in the story, as you tell it, as in real life, when Piper's in prison, her boyfriend writes a piece for the New York Times about having a fiance in prison. Mm-hmm. He's already told part of her story.
Right.
And apparently he'd like to tell more, and he'd like to tell it to this Ira Glass character. So what did you, I know you don't do a lot of advanced thinking, but really, what did you want to do by introducing this character into your story?
Well, a few things. First of all, I'm a huge Ira Glass fan. I'm a huge fan of radio in general. I don't have a whole lot of time to watch TV, but I am a big podcast listener and radio listener and a fangirl to a certain extent. And I actually asked Ira Glass if he would do it, and he politely declined.
Oh, you're kidding. Really?
Yeah. And in terms of storytelling, we wanted a way for all the prisoners to be able to experience his betrayal, if you will. He's sort of co-opting her experience and to make him feel useful and special. And radio is a great way to do that. And you could just have this voice telling a story. I find This American Life so compelling, and I engage on a very deep level with these stories. So I wanted that in our show, that a sense of that, and where everyone's quiet and listening, and he's saying things that he really shouldn't be saying.
Not Ira, but the fiancé.
Yeah, Larry.
Ira in quotes, right.
Ira's created an incredible model that I think has been interpreted and imitated in a lot of ways, and I guess it's our homage.
Have you spoken to him since the shows have been released?
I have not. I hope he's not. I have not spoken to him. I hope he's not mad at me. No, I haven't. I'd love to hear what he thinks.
And casting him? Casting the actor who you have portraying the Ira Glass?
Truthfully, we cast the guy who was best at it, but we did give him the glasses.
They're not exactly Ira's glasses.
They're not exactly, but, you know, there's a flavor.
Okay. Jenji Cohen, thank you so much for talking with us. Very generous of you to take some time out to talk with us while you're in the middle of shooting.
Oh, it's a treat.
Glad to hear season 2 is already underway. And, you know, congratulations on the success of the series, and thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jenji Cohen speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Cohen created the new Netflix series Orange is the New Black, which is based on the memoir of the same name by Piper Kerman, who was our guest earlier in the show. You can find both interviews on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, journalist Grayson Schaefer talks about his article, Disposable Man, A Western History of Sherpas on Everest. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The Sherpa people of Nepal have become famous for guiding mountain climbers up some of the world's highest peaks, especially Mount Everest. While Sherpa guides earn relatively good pay for their work, they and their families pay a price in death and injury. In fact, our next guest, journalist Grayson Schaefer, says Sherpa guides are 10 times more likely to die than commercial fishermen, the most dangerous occupation in the U.S., according to the Centers for Disease Control. Grayson Schaefer is a senior editor and staff writer at Outside Magazine. In the August issue, Schaefer writes about the frequency of debilitating injury and death for these Sherpas and how little financial protection they're given by the companies that hire them, even though those companies charge Western climbers thousands of dollars for a trip up Everest. Schaefer's also written about the dramatic increase in the number of climbers who are joining expeditions up Everest every year and its impact on the experience. Well, Grayson Schaefer, welcome to Fresh Air. So what are the challenges that humans face trying to climb Mount Everest? It's not a natural environment.
Well, there's generally two different types of hazards. There's sort of the physical kind of hazards, crevasses, getting hit by an avalanche, falling, and then there's this sort of physiological challenges. You know, at the summit of Everest, there's something like a third of the amount of oxygen that you have at sea level. And so in order to get your body to work with that level of stress, you have to acclimatize very slowly. And so what people will do is what's called rotations, where you'll go up to camp 2 and back down, up to camp 3 and back down, just getting your body used to the altitude, allowing your red blood cell count to go up so that you can use more of that thin air that's up there. And then in addition, once people get usually above about 23, 24,000 feet, they'll start on using bottled oxygen. And that is basically a scuba tank that goes to a delivery mask. And this is how people will get all the way to the summit of Everest. This is how mere mortals can get to the summit of Everest. There are, you know, a handful, probably fewer than 60, if you get rid of the liars and the people who slept with oxygen, who have actually climbed Everest without any oxygen.
And when you're making the trip with Sherpas, how much of the work are they doing? How much of the work are you doing? I mean, the basic work of preparing meals and pitching tents.
Yeah. I mean, Sherpas do everything. And I think a lot of people are pretty quick to recognize that. Climbers often talk about risk mitigation, that they are constantly trying to mitigate the risk. And one of the sort of the dirtiest secrets of that, I think, is that the biggest thing you can do to mitigate your risk on a mountain like Everest is paying somebody to carry your tent and your stove and all of your equipment up the mountain, doing all those laps for you. Because if the death rate is 1.2% for a climber going up Everest, just making the minimum number of trips, you can imagine how high it would be if you also had to do all of the laps. You know, once you get into base camp, the first thing that an expedition needs to do on Mount Everest from the south side is surmount the Khumbu Icefall, which is this giant hanging glacier between Camp 1 and base camp. And in order to tame that thing, you've got to get up there and get these tiny aluminum ladders strung across crevasses. You've got to get fixed ropes in. And then you've got to carry all of the gear, the stoves, the tents, the oxygen bottles. Everything needs to go up to Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3, Camp 4 in this sort of pyramid style of building and depositing materiel. And so the Sherpas are really responsible for all of that. They set the route, they set the ladders, and you know, when you actually see climbers going up the mountain, one of the things that people will do is carry just their 8,000-meter down suit. This is the suit that kind of makes people look like the Michelin Man. And as they're going up the sort of shoulders of the mountain, they will put just that suit in their pack so it looks like they have a full pack, but in fact it's very light. And then if you look at the Sherpa who's climbing next to him, that guy will have, you know, a 50 or an 80-pound pack, and you can tell that they're just straining into the straps.
Apart from their proximity to Everest and these other peaks, what makes them so good at what they do?
Well, this basically the word Sherpa means people from the East, and these are ethnic Tibetans who have fled China and ended up in the sort of high valleys of the Khumbu region. And so these people have spent thousands of years at altitude and developed certain genetic enhancements that allow them to perform a little bit better at high altitude than the rest of us, even with the acclimatization process.
Now, what kinds of insurance, if any, is required for Sherpas on an expedition? Because, I mean, in many cases they're injured, not killed, and there are expensive rescues. And then, of course, they're dealing with, you know, the needs of the family when a fatality occurs. What kinds of insurance do they have?
When a Sherpa dies in the mountains, you have these two worlds that kind of diverge. And on the one side, the Americans, you know, the Western climbers will see, you know, a fallen climber and feel sorry for him, feel, you know, devastated that they've lost a teammate, and they'll pass around a hat usually and try to come up with some money for the family. And on the other side, there's this sort of private grieving that goes on in the villages. And the family generally gets, since about 2000, 2002, there's a $4,500 insurance payment that the family will get from a private insurer that's mandated through the government. And then there's this whole series of rituals that the family will go through. They'll have a what's called a puja ceremony where the body is cremated and sent to the afterlife for reincarnation. And in Buddhist culture, the Sherpa are primarily Buddhist, the more expensive the puja, the better the afterlife the deceased gets. So it's extremely important for them, one, to get the body so that they can cremate it. And so in a lot of these mountaineering accidents, that becomes problematic because a lot of these bodies end up, you know, in the bottom of a crevasse or someplace where you just can't get to them. And then the other is the expense that goes into these puja ceremonies. So a lot of times the family will get a $4,500 insurance payment and relatives of the family will have already committed them to shows of faith that will cost much more than that. And so for a lot of the widows of fallen climbers, they've lost not only their primary breadwinner, they've also instantly accrued debt in excess of the insurance payment. And a lot of these climbers have been supporting not only their own immediate families, but the families of many of their brothers and sisters as well.
So when Western climbers go to expeditions up Everest and other mountains, do they know, you know, what the arrangements are for the Sherpas and their needs?
You know, I think that there's a real misperception about that. I mean, I think that there's an assumption that because it's 2013, that all of the sort of labor issues that might have been in the past, that those kind of things have been resolved and that these people are basically well cared for. At this point, we've recognized that climbing Mount Everest is no longer sort of the pinnacle of mountaineering achievement. There's no climb that you can do on the south face of Everest that is going to make Alpinist magazine write a profile of you. It's essentially the pinnacle of adventure tourism. And the thing to understand about the Sherpa workforce is that there's no other tourism industry in the world that so frequently kills and maims its workers for the benefit of paying clients. And that's just something that people have not yet, I think, connected the dots on. That a 1% mortality rate for somebody who is choosing to climb a mountain is acceptable, but a 1% mortality rate for the people who they rely on to get their stuff up the mountain is, as a workplace safety statistic, is just outrageous.
Because they go again and again.
That's right. If you're a Western climber, you're climbing the mountain once and you're done. If you're a Sherpa, you're doing lap after lap after lap through this roulette wheel of hazards that we know has a death rate long-term of 1.2%. And that number makes climbing Everest as a Sherpa more dangerous than, you know, working on a crab boat in Alaska. It makes it more dangerous than being an infantryman in the first 4 years of the Iraq War. The thing that hides that number is that the season is relatively short and a relatively small workforce. But when you actually run the numbers of fatalities through any workplace safety statistic calculator, you come up with this just sort of outrageous number for how dangerous this line of work is.
You've written another piece about the sheer volume of humanity that is going up Everest as summiting the peak has become more common. And you describe going to the base camp, which is, I guess, 17,600 feet altitude. You want to describe just what you saw when you got there?
Yeah, I mean, the base camp is this sort of – it's the most amazing thing. I had placed base camp on maps, you know, for years and years working it outside, and had always sort of thought of it as being right at the sort of crook in the elbow of the where the Khumbu icefall comes down and sweeps left into the Khumbu Glacier. And in fact, that's where the base camp starts, but it wraps for almost a mile down around that entire bend and really takes over that entire glacier. I mean, this is at least 1,000 tents with your Western climbers, your Sherpa workforce, journalists, helicopters. There's an emergency room that's set up there to give medical support to the climbers and to the Sherpas. A couple of expeditions have full bars set up. There was a whiskey tasting room last year. It's just this sort of amazing sprawl of humanity at 17,600 feet.
It's like a miner's boom town almost.
It's very much like that. I think, you know, there's a lot of commerce going on there. And, you know, when the porter comes up who's carrying nothing but beer on his back, they call that guy the beer truck. And then you've got the sort of refuse and human waste needs to go in and out every day. So there'll be, you know, yak trains and trains of porters coming in, carrying new supplies in and carrying the blue barrels of waste out. And, yeah, it's this sort of fully functioning city that pops up every spring.
And different kinds of people are trying to make the trip, right? I mean, it used to be that you had to have some experience and a level of fitness.
That's right. It used to be that Everest was sort of like a capstone experience to finish off an already great climbing career. I mean, this was, until the late 80s, only sort of the top echelon of national teams would be doing this sort of for God and country, that sort of thing, you know, becoming the first Israeli or the first Egyptian to climb Everest, that sort of thing. You still see a bit of that, but more now, this is doctors and lawyers and people of means who just decide that they want to climb Mount Everest, that either that it's a dream for them or that that's something that they want to do, regardless of whether they have a lot of experience climbing. And in 2012, we saw a couple of people who had never even strapped on crampons, who paid the money, showed up, and gave it a try.
Well, Grayson Schaefer, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Grayson Schaefer's article, Disposable Man, is published in the August edition of Outside Magazine. You'll find a slideshow of Schaefer's photographs of Sherpas and a link to his article on our website, freshair.npr.org. Valerie June is a singer-songwriter from Tennessee who's just released her first major label album, Pushing Against a Stone. It was co-produced by Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the album does a good job of showcasing June's powerful voice.
Valerie June wants to be on your mind, to get inside your head. She writes or co-writes songs that mix blues, gospel, folk, and soul, and which describe emotional isolation, financial deprivation, and an insecurity about her place in the world. She's unafraid to proclaim her neediness, perhaps because possessed of a big, powerful voice, she knows that her vulnerability isn't likely to come off as passive or self-pitying.
Well, if you're tired and feeling so lonely, you wake up at night thinking that only if you had somebody, will I be somebody, you're somebody to love. Did the day there were plenty fish in the sea, but you're out in the cold and you're feeling empty, looking for somebody. Will I be somebody, somebody to love? Will I be somebody?
That's Somebody to Love, an original song by Valerie June that manages to sound like a lost Appalachian fiddle song or an obscure blues stomp in which the stomping is done with a light tread. If you don't immediately key into June's strategy of simplicity, she might strike you as someone who's posing as a lonely poor girl, the way Lucinda Williams poses as an artless outlaw, or the way Mumford and Sons pose as world-weary folkies. But as Valerie June moves through this album, her journey becomes absorbing. You take in the sights with her, and qualms about authenticity or attitude melt away.
I ain't fit to be no mother. I ain't fit to be no wife yet. I've been working like a man, y'all. I've been working all my life, yeah. All my life, y'all. All my life, yeah.
first, I thought that one element that this album lacked was a sense of humor, but then I started picking up on June's tart one. For example, the way she says near the end of that song, Working Woman Blues, "Lord, you know that I am ready for my sugar daddy," as though beseeching God for a rich man to solve her problems is a serious prayer. She's sly, but she's also up for a challenge. The biggest stylistic chance she takes on this album is to settle her voice in amongst the big ringing guitars Dan Auerbach and others play on the title song, Pushing Against a Stone. The melody, the lyrics, and the organ riff try to insist that this is a song of doom, a duel with the devil, even as her voice tells you she knows she's already triumphant. Marketplace will do what it will with Valerie June. She'll either be perceived as a quaint semi-novelty act and become a cult artist, or her ringing voice will excite the ears of people now trained to hear big voices by Adele and by TV shows like The Voice, and she'll become a star. Either way, she's made an album that slices across styles and decades of popular music with a cutting canniness that will serve her well in the future, whatever it may be.
Ken Tucker reviewed Valerie June's debut album, Pushin' Against a Stone. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.